In 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hello, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 19. We've been doing these for 19 weeks, Grierson. I feel like I actually finally know and understand you as a person now.
Oh, thank God.
This is Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 19. Welcome. We encourage you, as always, to find our work at The New Republic. Follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach, and also, remember, before we get kicked off this week, that you should subscribe to us on iTunes and give us a positive review. If you give us a positive review, we will talk about, and this is the name of a movie, we will talk about the movie you would like to talk about. Now, this week, Grierson, very exciting. We did not have a reboot segment last week, for which, I feel like we deprive people a little bit, and not just the guy that keeps yelling at me to review John Wick every week. Literally, like, it's now on every 2 days. He knows we do only one podcast a week. And still, every day, it is, where's John Wick, where's John Wick, where's John Wick? All right, so this week, the review comes to us from Alan Sepinwall, the old host of the great Fireberg and Ice Wall podcast, or the late, great, whatever they called it. I've lost it. It's been so long, I've forgotten what it was. But it was a great television podcast. He's, of course, Alan Sepinwall, the great writer of What's Alan Watching, the blog, and for HitFix. He is a fan of Midnight Run. Here's what he says about our podcast. It is a smart, fun film discussion. Tim and Will know their stuff and talk about it well, and they will discuss any movie you mention in a review here. I was going to be mean and force them to review American Anthem, which I have to say, I would rather watch American Anthem than The Room, but that's okay. We're going to do The Room someday anyway. But I'll give them a choice between that and Midnight Run. So as tempting as it was to do American Anthem, we are reviewing Midnight Run on our reboot section. But this week, we have two new releases because Tim is back from Cannes. You're back on your regular schedule. Do you miss France?
No, I'm actually very happy to be home. I had a fun time at the festival, but 2 weeks was enough to be away from home. So I'm very happy to be back.
Okay, so this week we're going to talk about two movies, the first of which is X-Men Apocalypse.
What is it?
Oh, God. He can control all of us.
Charles!
The world needs the X-Men.
That's why I'm here, to fight.
Not all of us can control our powers.
Then don't. This is war.
Everything they built will fall, and from the ashes of their world, we'll build a better one.
Yes, this is the sixth, depending on how you measure these things, I guess, this is either the sixth film in the X-Men sort of franchise, or the ninth film if you're including the Deadpool movie and the two Wolverine films. But this is the fourth one directed by Bryan Singer, who started this whole thing way back in 2000, the first X-Men movie. This one picks up where 2014's Days of Future Past,
of which we were both fond.
Quite fond. In fact, that was my favorite film of the X-Men movies. I think in terms of just quickly backing up, I'm trying to remember, Will, when X-Men X2 came out back in the early 2000s, I liked them, but I wasn't the biggest fan of them. Were you? I'm trying to think.
I liked them more than you because I love, they felt like they had, and we talked about this with past X-Men movies. It felt like they had that kind of outsider notion. I think Singer kind of brought to it this kind of like using the mutation as a metaphor for being the other and being an outsider. And I actually thought that really came across, particularly in the second one. I thought it was actually stronger in the second one than it was in the first one. So I liked that. And I was very sad when he stopped doing them and Brett Ratner took them over. But now he's back. He's back.
Yes, and so the new one picks up where the last one, Days of Future Past, left. That one was set in 1973. The new one, X-Men Apocalypse, is set in 1983. And so we're in the 80s, and the movie stars James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Jennifer Lawrence, Rose Byrne is back. The new face is Oscar Isaac, who plays the millennia-old character who you might as well just call Apocalypse, who
I am told, by the way, that is Oscar Isaac. I've reliable sources that claim.
Yes.
I'm not sure, having watched the movie, but apparently it is, in fact, you can confirm, Grierson, it is the fantastic, charismatic, wonderful, hot internet boyfriend that is Oscar Isaac. That's him under all that stuff, right?
That is.
I'll take your word for it. I'll take your word for it.
You can, dear listener, as you might sense already, a conflict, a tension between the two.
Yes.
But we haven't gotten into this yet, so let's get into it. So Oscar Isaac is the bad guy, and in the grand tradition of comic book bad guys, he wants to A, take over the planet, and B, enslave humanity, and C, talk in a very kind of slow, methodic, deep voice while doing it. So, you know, as per norm, the good guys and the bad guys in the X-Men universe have to get together to defeat Apocalypse. Okay, so let's get into this. The reason why I wanted to establish the fact that I was not the biggest fan of the first X-Men movies, which I liked but didn't love, I need to say that because I am very much the minority of people who have very much liked the more recent X-Men movies. Days of Future Past is still my favorite, but I also really like Apocalypse. And I think it's partly because Bryan Singer is back. He directed the last one. He directed this one. I think that, you know, when Singer left X2 to do Superman Returns and then do Valkyrie and that Jack the Giant Slayer, I think that, you know, for better or for worse, the X-Men movies are kind of Bryan Singer's life project. I think that he understands this franchise, these characters, these movies better than anybody else. And I think the two things that have really kind of helped the last movie and this movie is that I think that they are more emotional than other comic book movies. I think that they are also much more coherent. One of the big problems I think we have now in the comic book world is, whether it's Civil War or even Batman vs. Superman, is that we now have this thing of, if one superhero is good, 25 is great. We just have to cram as many different characters as possible into these movies. I think what helps the X-Men movies is that there are clear main characters and there are clear supporting characters. And that's the way it's been since the first one. There are the characters that you like and you like to see more of, and the characters you sort of enjoy in the periphery. In both Days of Future Past and the new movie Apocalypse, a character like Quicksilver does not need his own standalone movie, but he is very good for like two or three scenes per movie. And like in Days of Future Past, he has a fantastic sequence in this movie where, because he moves so fast, he can essentially move in such a way that when we are watching it, it's almost as it's in slow motion. I love that sequence in the last movie. I love it in this one. And I just love the fact that, and I imagine Will feels differently about this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think that the overall thread that have always been part of the X-Men movies, which is number one, this idea about family, and then number two, this idea about being an outcast and how being an outcast is both a blessing and a curse, that in some ways you are special and different from other people, which is both amazing and also very alienating. I think that that resonates through these movies. I think it especially resonates through Apocalypse. As Will alluded to, Oscar Isaac is buried in makeup and a costume. And I think most kind of critically, he's buried in this kind of digital effect they do to his voice so that you can't necessarily recognize his voice. I've seen this movie twice now. I saw it for the first time before I went to Cannes, and then I saw it again when I got back from Cannes, because after seeing like 25 movies in Cannes, I really had to refresh my memory about Apocalypse. I think Oscar Isaac works perfectly fine in this movie. I don't think that he is great, as you alluded to, Will. He is not the charismatic person that we know from Inside Llewyn Davis, or even Drive, for that matter.
Or especially
Star Wars. But I think that that is actually not so much of a problem as I think the internet has made it out to be, because I think that he is sort of supposed to be kind of a monotone, imposing force in this movie. I think he actually works just fine. I find this movie incredibly moving, and I will also say that I think that Bryan Singer, as opposed to certain other action directors, directs action sequences in a way that are not claustrophobic or confusing, which is, you know, saying a lot, because in the end of this movie, you have sort of this battle royale between like 20 characters or so. I don't lose a sense of where I am in this space. I think actually Singer does it very economically. It's close, but I will say that I like this movie better than Civil War. I think this is the best comic book movie I've seen this year. I like it a lot. I look forward to my colleague from Athens, Georgia now to disagree with me. But I think this movie is actually quite tremendous.
I think I just got scooped. First off, secondly, it's worth noting, just to be very clear, I'm also aware of the general critical consensus on this. I like it more than that. I will say, I think there's the Quicksilver scene is very well done. You're right about the general sincerity in these movies. There's a war. There is. I like that they are a little dorky. It's weird to think that the X-Men franchise has been around long enough, 16 years now, that it almost feels like nostalgic and clunky in a lot of ways. But I actually didn't mind that part of it. It's actually one of the main reasons I really liked Days of Future Past. Right? I thought it was terrific. And the thing I liked the most about it was it took all of these characters that we kind of knew a little bit, but put them into a new story. It felt like I think it was actually based off like a special edition of the comic book where
right.
the old version yeah. could play with the old version of characters could play with the young version of characters, and therefore they could cross parallel universes. And at the end, they'd all go back to the regular storylines, which I kind of liked that idea. I liked the idea that it was almost a standalone comic book movie, which you don't really get to do anymore. So I really enjoyed that part. The problem is you know, it's funny when you were talking about when you were kind of summarizing the plot of this movie, you actually used the phrase, well, as per norm. And I feel like that is actually, this is called X-Men Apocalypse, but I feel like it's X-Men as per norm, which is the general problem with the movie. Is there's two main problems. One, and let's just get the Oscar Isaac thing out of the way. It's not like Oscar Isaac is bad in this movie. It's just this is a unusually lame villain. And listen, he wants to take over the universe. He wants to everyone to kneel before him, whatever. We've seen all that before. But really, his quest in the movie, he has to go get these four horsemen. And again, maybe in the comic books, this is a big deal to go get all these four horsemen. He has to compile his staff. But basically all he does is he takes existing mutants and like gives them makeovers is essentially what he does for like the entire movie.
It's Apocalypse Extreme Makeover is the movie, yes.
I think vitriol that's been thrown against this movie is general comic book movie fatigue.
Yeah, I still like Days of Future Past better. A couple responses. Number one, the thing that actually I think works really well with the Apocalypse character is the reason why he's, or what works, I think, sort of thematically about that character is that he's essentially going around and making people who feel like outcasts embrace their powers. And I think that's actually part of what, you know, in terms of what he's doing.
But isn't that what Magneto and the bald guy have been doing for the last four movies too? The last 12 movies or ever?
Yeah, but I think that is, because I know that people have talked about this idea of, oh, well, it's the same thing. Magneto's still doing this. Charles Xavier is still doing this. Oh,
I'm one of those people that said that. I literally just said that.
Yeah, they're still in conflict. I do not find that to be repetitive or a problem. That to me is essentially the core conflict of these movies. So to me, that continuing thread of their sort of debate, I mean, the thing I wrote in the review I did for us for The New Republic is that I don't think you go to these movies going, oh, I wonder if Magneto is going to change his mind, or I wonder if Xavier is going to change his mind about this stuff. Basically, they're on the opposite sides of a spectrum in terms of how they feel about these things, and each movie is about them essentially squaring off again and again. It's not about one of them being right or proving the other person wrong. It's essentially them squaring off again and again. And I don't mind that. That actually works just fine for me. And one of the reasons why I do like this movie better than Civil War, and we talked about this a little bit when we talked about Civil War, to me, a movie like Civil War is, it's sold as all of your favorite superheroes are going to like choose sides and square off. And don't worry, we'll have a reason that's somewhat socially relevant, but not in a way that's, you know, remotely kind of subversive or interesting. And in Civil War, the whole reason why they you know, kind of split up into teams is, you know, what are our powers and what's the responsibility of our powers? Now, again, in the Avengers universe, that's kind of the recurring thread. This idea of, should we be policed? Should somebody be watching over us? You know, do we have the ability to kind of, you know, self-control with our powers? I find that repetition of that theme a lot less interesting than the repetition of the theme in the X-Men movies, which I think is much more topical and relevant. And again, I actually find resonant in these movies. To me, this idea of being an outsider, because when watching this movie, I was thinking, you know, wow, when these movies started in 2000, the idea of the mutants being a metaphor for homosexuality and society at large's resistance and revulsion in certain ways, how much that has changed over time. But at the same time, the idea of prejudice and minority groups being sort of abused by a culture at large, that remains. And so for me, that thread through the X-Men movies remains really resonant. Whereas, by example, in Civil War, I think this feels like a bunch of talk to justify action sequences. In the X-Men movies, even though it may be repetitive, that theme is still resonant. And I think that that still kind of speaks to something and justifies these movies in a way that I mean, the ending of this movie, I can always say it like this. Like, I've seen it two times now. Both times, the way it resolves itself, I actually find very, very emotional. And I actually like how it works. Even though I know what those themes are, and even though they've done it over and over again, it still works really, really nicely for me. So yeah, so take that.
So ultimately, I give it a C+. So
Of the three movies, I think we would agree that Days of Future Past is the best of all three of those.
I'll give you that. Yes.
I would agree. I give this a B+. I think it is very strong. I enjoyed it.
All right, you go. Well, all right, well then good, because you're going to see it again in a couple of years. So there you go. You
get to go. Well, I have to say that may not, I mean, the fact that it's not doing super well, we may not. I think now that we've had this back and forth, this lively back and forth about X-Men Apocalypse, I think we should come together in agreement about a movie.
Yes. So our next movie, I suspect there will not be much disagreement on this one, is Alice Through the Looking Glass.
When the day becomes the night, and the sky becomes the sea, when the clock strikes heavy, and there's no time for tea, and in our darkest hour, before my final rhyme, come back home to Wonderland and turn back the hands of time.
Alice Through the Looking Glass is directed by James Bobin. Is it Bobin?
I'm going to say Bobin.
Okay, I'm going to say Bobin just to fight you, because we're going to agree on everything else on this one. It is the sequel to the 2010... Always a bad sign, by the way, when there's a sequel to a movie that people kind of mostly just tolerated last time and were not particularly excited about, and it's 6 years later. Like, that's generally a bad sign. This is not like a matter of like people... They've been fighting creatively over this movie for so long, it just could not get it right, and finally they can break through and get the funding for the movie that people have been banging down the doors to see. Of course, stars Mia. I can never say it. Say it, Grayson.
Mia Vashkakoska.
She plays Alice once again. This time, Alice is older. She's as one would be from 6 years later.
Don't reveal all the spoilers, Will, in the plot description.
She is older. She's not actually regressed in age, but hey, who knows what can happen in Wonderland. She is Alice. She's like a ship captain now, apparently. But it turns out she finds out that the Mad Hatter, played by Johnny Depp, is sad. So she has to go. She has a very poor idea, in retrospect, to go back to Wonderland, and realizes to make him, because he thinks his parents are alive, and therefore she needs to go back in time and save them from dying. It's basically is the last refuge of the desperate sequel. Let's go back in time. Let's just go back in time and do that. So she runs into everybody's back. Anne Hathaway doing whatever I never quite know what Anne Hathaway's doing in these movies. This is Anne Hathaway, Helena Bonham Carter as the Red Queen. It's the last, I did not mention this in my review, but it's actually the last film appearance of Alan Rickman. He is the voice of the butterfly, I think. Who knows? Who cares, really? I mean, no offense to Alan Rickman. You know what I mean. The new addition this time is Sacha Baron Cohen. He plays time itself, or as it was a relief. I mentioned this in my review. It was a relief after I got out of the screening. Literally, the first thing I did was type in Sacha Baron Cohen, Werner Herzog. Because he's doing a Werner Herzog accent in this movie. The entire movie, I'm like, is this purposeful? Am I imagining this? Am I the only person that noticed this? Apparently, there were three other idiots that noticed this as well. So he's doing a Werner Herzog. My main issue with this movie, among many, many issues, is, and this is why I wrote my review, there's an old Gene Siskel, he's always talk about how his thing for a movie was, test for a movie was, is this movie more interesting than the actor, what a documentary of the actors having lunch? Now, I have to confess, I never entirely understood that because, I mean, maybe Gene Siskel just had a lot more interesting lunches than I did because I never, like, my lunches are just me, like my lunches are like most American workers, just like shoving food into my face at my desk as I type. But I always thought it was better to see, do the actors feel engaged by what's going on? Do they look like they're having fun? Do they feel challenged? Do they look like this is something that they did are not just like jumping in from the trailer while reading scripts for more interesting projects and then running back to the trailer? I don't remember the last time, and this is from Johnny Depp on down. We'll talk about Depp. I don't remember the last time I actually saw all the actors being so actively disengaged. And that includes Sacha Baron Cohen, who is ostensibly the guy that should be stepping up in this movie, and he's the new character. Everyone looks very dispirited. The movie has like no life to it at all. It's not even Tim Burton anymore. I thought like maybe James Bobin, who did the Muppets movies, which I think we both liked. You liked the second one a lot. I thought this would like add an extra twist to it, or add something different, or add something. This looks like everybody just wanted to get this over with as quickly as possible.
This movie is terrible. The James Bobin thing gave me hope. I liked the first Muppets reboot. I really liked Muppets Most Wanted. And what I especially liked is that both of those movies to me felt like, hey, you love this franchise. It's a little kind of long in the tooth. Let's just kind of have a light touch and remind you why you like these characters so much and just really capture that sense of play. And I think that worked really well in both Muppets movies. So I actually had hope that Bobin would be able to kind of work against the Tim Burton aesthetic, which both Will and I absolutely cannot stand and find so.
What's the last Tim Burton movie? What's the last, not counting the one, the Big Eyes.
Yes.
But give me the last Tim Burton movie like this, the big budget. What's the last one you liked?
Mars Attacks.
Yeah, wow.
Is that the last one? Yeah, I think so. Right.
Wow, that's a very long. That's literally 20 years.
So my hope, excuse me, was that James Bobin could do something here, but within about 10 minutes, I think it was pretty clear that he is stuck with that aesthetic. I mean, I think it's always important to mention this, and I say this every time I get a chance. I still contend that the reason why Alice in Wonderland, which came out in 2010, which was such a big hit, was because it was the first big 3D movie after Avatar. And so people, I think, had this craving for, number one, a 3D movie, and number two, both Johnny Depp and Tim Burton were not looked at as the damaged goods commercially that they are now. I think there was sort of this pent-up kind of demand for that movie, and it kind of rode. It made $1 billion worldwide. I think people kind of forget that because it's been so long ago. Now you watch this movie, the sequel, and, you know, for me, it's always tough because a lot of times in reviews, you'll see people say like, oh, the actors look bored. And I think, well, are they really bored or are we bored watching them? It's not that they're bored. It's just that this to me is one of like the great, awful green screen movie since the Star Wars prequels, where it just feels like there's a bunch of candy colored crap everywhere, just everywhere on the screen. There was a time when I liked Helena Bonham Carter. There was a time when I liked Sacha Baron Cohen. There was a time when I liked Johnny Depp. Watching them go through this movie is just to be reminded of just how that Tim Burton idea of what whimsy looks like or what kind of a fantastical world looks like is, I mean, this is the type of movie that makes you break out in hives. I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to leave the theater.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what kids get out of a movie like this, because even as a timeless story, or even as a message about, I don't know, appreciating your family or appreciating the time that you have on Earth. Like, none of that even sort of scans. It's just sort of excruciating. Like you said so well in your plot description, she's a captain now. Okay.
Okay, so I feel like we need to, because I feel the same way about this. There's definitely a moment. I around the 45-minute mark, that's when I hit that. Okay, I need this to end, like, really soon. It's, like, really important for me, for you to stop, for you guys to stop doing this. So, okay, so to wrap this up, I kind of think we need to talk about Johnny Depp for a moment. I don't want to talk about the whatever the news, the accusations that have come out, extra textual, as our friend Scott Phipps would say. I will say that, like, there's a couple times in this movie where I'm like, dude, you're in like your 50s. Like, what are you doing? There is, and it's funny, you know, if you look, the thing that's disturbing about Johnny Depp, and I talked about this a little bit in Black Mass and talked about it in Mordecai, because I don't think he's good in Black Mass either. And one of the things that I think Johnny Depp is now basically broken is that, like, he's always been, even in his good roles, there's always been something a little extra worldly about him and a little, like, not quite like the rest of us. But now, like, as after a while, that just becomes shtick if there's no soul in it and there's no investment in it. And now you see him when he's trying to play Whitey Bulger in Progress Menace, and it just doesn't work. It feels like he is now a series of ticks impersonating an actor. And it's funny, I looked through his IMDb. I was like, well, when is the last time I liked Johnny Depp in the movie? And the only thing I came up with in like the last 10 years, I think almost since Donnie Brasco, was his cameo in 21 Jump Street. Was like the one that, because he's like playing a recognizable human being for a moment, even if it's the same recognizable human being he played 30 years ago as a teenager. It was a reminder that Johnny Depp used to, like, there used to be something sort of fun about him, and now he just looks like he wants this all to go away. And I kind of agree with him.
Yes, the problem is he has now reached that point for me, and I think for a lot of people, I can't physically watch him on screen. I don't find it actually actively pleasurable in any way to watch him or look at him on screen. And especially because he's supposed to be, what's funny about this movie as opposed to the first film is that he's supposed to be more of the poignant, damaged, emotional character. If there's like an arc or some sort of point to this story, it's that, like, oh, you knew him as just the, like, you know, ridiculously cartoonish Mad Hatter in the first movie. Well, now he's got like extra like pathos and depth. Well, spoiler alert, there is none there. And it's hard to watch him do anything that requires an emotional connection from me, because I just think I can't do it. Because I think part of the idea of being a film critic or just someone watching movies is you have to meet that performance halfway and go, okay, I'm going to see what you can do. I'm going to give it a shot. I'll give you a chance. I'll give you your day in court. I think Johnny Depp has broken that contract with us in a certain way, where it is impossible for me to say, you know, I still feel like I do my job, but I go, it's going to be really hard for me. But again, to be fair, Sacha Baron Cohen and several other actors, those tweedles, when I die and if I end up in hell, mm-hmm. I will be stuck with the tweedles for all of eternity. those two actors and those characters. I think I've seen a worse movie this year than this movie, but I don't want to spend any time thinking about which of those was was worse, because this thing is just this big train wreck of awfulness. It's just absolutely terrible. I'm sorry for anybody who has to take kids to see it this weekend. I'm so sorry. This thing is so terrible.
Yes, I'm with you. I gave it a straight up D.
I also gave it a straight up D. D as in damn, this thing is god awful.
As in so, deadly. As in boy, you
poor James. And I say the only person I feel bad for is James Bobbin, because I really had like hope that maybe, but it's an insurmountable battle. This is his Vietnam. It's just impossible.
All right, so now it is time for our reboot segment. This week, the movie is Midnight Run.
Robert De Niro is a bounty hunter.
Did your mother ever teach you how to talk nice to people and not shoot at them?
Charles Grodin is an accountant who embezzled $15 million from the mob.
It is truly in your best interest to just relax.
I'm totally relaxed.
I want this guy taken out, and I want him taken out fast.
The mob wants him dead. The FBI want him alive.
I'm going to bring him into federal court. Do I make myself understood?
These sunglasses, they're really nice. Are they government issued, or do all you guys go like to the same store to get them?
Midnight Run was directed by Martin Brest and came out in 1998. It stars Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. As Robert De Niro is a bounty hunter out to bring Charles Grodin, who is an accountant who has stolen millions of dollars from the mob, specifically Dennis Farina. And he has to get him from across the country while being chased by feds, while being chased by the mob, by being chased by other bounty hunters, by being chased by almost everyone. And, of course, a large part of the movie is the rapport between the two of them. Grace, I want you to kind of start us off a little bit. I kind of want to kick us into it with a glint. I think a critical colleague whose work I enjoy quite a bit is Glenn Kinney, and he wrote a book from his Anatomy of an Actor book series. He looked at Robert De Niro, and he talked about how there's an excerpt of this. If you want to go on Vulture, you can find an excerpt from this about that. He talks about how unusual it was that. Now we think of Robert De Niro as this guy that's in mainstream movies and does all of these things. But at the time, he was still Robert De Niro, unbankable actor guy. And so to cross him with someone like Charles Grodin, I think, is the central gimmick of the movie, and I think is the reason the movie is held up. So, Grierson, here's my question to you. How much does Midnight Run held up? It has a very positive reputation. How much do you think it holds up to watch it today?
I think it holds up really well. And I think I agree with Glenn, but I also think what's great and why the movie has lasted is that you actually don't need to know that story in terms of the backstory of how it came together and what was at the time a somewhat daring isn't the right word, but this idea of if we put this actor with this actor, what would that be like? Because I think now you can simply watch this movie, and especially if you watch it now, you think, oh, Robert De Niro actually can be really funny. Because I think we went at length about what Johnny Depp has done wrong in recent years. And I think in some ways you can almost say the same thing with De Niro in terms of his comedy roles, especially, is that it really has calcified into a shtick. And watching Midnight Run now is to be reminded of, oh, this is, because in terms of orienting people, in terms of reminding us where De Niro was in his career, this is 2 years before Goodfellas, because this came out in 1988. And so he's still kind of primarily thought of as a serious, committed, capital A actor. And when we ranked De Niro's comedic performances for Vulture last year, I wrote about this for Midnight Run, is that I think what works in this movie is that essentially, it is a comedy. It's a buddy comedy, action comedy sort of thing. But De Niro doesn't really play it as if he's doing a comedy. He's funny in the movie, but it doesn't feel the way his more recent performances feel, like, hey, this is a comedy. In Midnight Run, he doesn't deliver lines as if he knows they're going to get a laugh. They're just sort of like these nice zingers, because what works so well in the film is you have Charles Grodin, the king of deadpan, doing his thing, which is, I mean, you look at Grodin in this and go, oh, this is the type of thing that he was just doing over and over again during that time and doing it so well. And De Niro is kind of just reacting off of that. Though I think in some ways, De Niro is more of the main character, obviously. The movie, I think, really comes to life when the two of them are put together, because there's something that, as opposed to, say, like the Meet the Parents movies, De Niro underplays so beautifully, I think, in this movie. And at the same time, just to kind of keep harping on this, that character is actually pretty nuanced. The whole backstory about what happened to him, why he's a bounty hunter now, what happened to his family in Chicago, that scene when he goes back to Chicago.
I wanted to talk about that scene. So.
Yeah, I mean, that scene, I think, is really, I had forgotten that moment and thought, you know, again, it's not like it's not a grabber, it's not a tear-jerking moment, but it's so nicely done.
Particularly the way that when the daughter comes in, daughter comes in, and it's basically like he asks her, what grade are you in now? And she says seventh. And then, I mean, there's literally nothing either one of them can say after that. I think it's so played so well by both of them.
And I also have to say, I specifically love when she gives him all of her money. I had forgotten that. And then thought, wait, does he take it? Like, no, he doesn't. And there's something that's just so great. George Gallo wrote this screenplay. And this was, he never wrote anything, or at least it wasn't credited with a script ever as great as this one. But in terms of like a model of how to do like a buddy comedy, and also how to give the both characters a certain amount of depth. Because as zany as parts of this movie are, there's actually something very serious underneath, which is that if Robert De Niro succeeds, if he makes the money that he needs to make, which he desperately needs, and so we're rooting for him, Charles Grodin's character is probably going to die. He is going to be killed in prison by the people who are out to get him. And I really love how Martin Brest never lets you really forget that. There's a real sense of stakes of what's going to happen at the end of this thing. And the way it resolves, I don't want to jump ahead, but the way it resolves, I absolutely love. It's such a smart way of kind of getting around the problem of, you know, how can both of these characters end up happy when it doesn't seem like it's either going to be one or the other, essentially.
Yeah, and I agree. And, you know, the movie is the two of them. And I feel like nitpicking to get some of the things that don't work well, because the two of them, every scene with them works great, pretty much start to finish. And they both are fascinating people. And the idea, too, I also like one thing I was afraid, it had been a while since I'd seen it, I was afraid Grodin was going to be a little too, like, you can see when they pitch the movie, it would almost say, like, there's a bounty hunter and there's, like, this insufferable rich guy who has all of these phobias and all of these problems, but he's too good for that. And he's too good of an actor and the character's drawn too well to let it really be that easy in a lot of ways. The way it's funny, this is a Charles Grodin character, but it feels like this is not, like, you know, in a way they're both kind of suffering each other. In a lot of ways, I think that works well. It's not like one of them is like, oh, how's he have to put up with Charles Grodin? How's he have to put up with Robert De Niro? They actually are just kind of these people who kind of interact with each other and ultimately kind of get this begrudging respect in a way that obviously is the template of the buddy movie. But I think really feels well, and I think at the moment where there's a decision made where like they acknowledge, oh, we are friends and this is actually the right thing to do here, it's affecting. I think it's undeniably affecting. There are things in the movie that don't hold up as well. It's a little busy in that there's a lot of now we're in a plane, now we're in a train. Like, I find that stuff, like, probably when written is important. I think I understand, listen, we need to keep them moving. We need to have it continue to be propulsive. But I found myself, like, while not quite as entranced with all of the supporting characters, in that, like, I think some of them are well drawn. I actually kind of like what they do with Yafikoto. I think he's actually kind of interesting. I don't think Dennis Farina, he's Dennis Farina. So, but I kind of like the other bounty hunter. But really, I have to say, watching it again, every scene that wasn't just the two of them, even if they're fine, I kind of wanted to end just to get back to the two of them.
I think the supporting characters, and we talked about this with the reboot that we did for Married to the Mob. The supporting characters in this movie remind you that this movie was an 80s movie. There's something very kind of 80s sitcom-y, very broad stereotypes of this type of character.
Or it feels a little Married to the Mob is what you're saying.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does. And so I think a lot of the side stuff feels much more like, because as we've talked about before, in general, describing a movie to me like, oh, is it an 80s comedy? Doesn't make me very happy. I also have, like, Ghostbusters. A lot of 80s comedies I think have not aged very well, because they feel kind of cookie cutter. And this movie, though I think it transcends it in a lot of ways, it does have some of those problems. That said, though, I think all the stuff in the airport in Las Vegas is actually really well done. I actually think it's actually smartly done.
But listen, it's to their credit, and to both their credits, they never made a sequel to this.
Well, it's funny. Because, you know, when we did the Vulture recap, or the Vulture kind of ranking of those roles, I mentioned, like, and one of the best things about this movie is that there were no sequels. And quickly people reminded me, because I never saw these, maybe right. Even, that there were all these, like, made-for-TV sequels. And I have no memory of this, but apparently...
It is called, I'm looking it up right now, it is called Another Midnight Run. The characters this time are Jack Walsh. You're right. I forgot anybody did this on Vulture 2, that there are, in fact, Midnight Run sequels. I'm sure Alan Sepinwall, listening to this, is screaming at his iPhone right now, because, like, I think I'm actually remembering now that he's actually written about this before. But Another Midnight Run, Jack Walsh this time is played by Christopher McDonald, a.k.a. Shooter McGavin, an actor I like a lot, by the way.
As do I, yes.
And this time, it's Jeffrey Tambor is a Bernie Madoff type of, before Bernie Madoff, his name is Bernie Abbott, but it's certainly that kind of character. Jeffrey, basically this time he's bringing in a Jeffrey Tambor and Kathy Moriarty, who are a, quote, a husband and wife team of con artists. So there's that one. Is there? And then there is, that one's called Midnight Run 2, Another Midnight Run. There were two more sequels after this one. Midnight Run Around, which is a TV movie that also had Christopher McDonald and Dan Hedaya. And then after Midnight Run Around, there was Midnight Run For Your Life, the last one. Also, all of these were from 1994. So I wonder, was this supposed to be a TV show? It was supposed to be a TV show, and then they decided, based around the Jack Walsh character, played by Christopher McDonald, and I guess they made it a movie. That would be my wager, actually. This was probably never meant to be a sequel as much as it was a new television show.
And I'm reminded once again that if you don't put numbers in your sequels, you will then forever go, which one came first, Another Midnight Run or Midnight Run Around?
Midnight Run For Your Life. They ran out of Midnight Run things. Midnight Runners.
Dawn of the Rise of the Planet.
Midnight Runaways. Midnight, Run. Midnight Runaways. All right. So anyway, obviously, no offense to Shooter McGavin, who is awesome, but just go see the original Midnight Run. It is available. I rented it on iTunes. I don't think it's available through streaming. So that is Midnight Run. All right, Grierson. So that is the show this week. I'm glad we got back to reboot. We had not done a reboot. I miss the reboots. And next week, we also have a reboot.
What will it be, out of curiosity?
Well, I'll give you a hint. But I've capitulated to the guy who kept yelling at me, what about John Wick? What about John Wick? What about John Wick? So we are going to review next week John Wick. So John Wick, of course, from 2014, directed by Chris Stahelski and David Leitch, spelled the same way as my name. I do not know him. I'm sure he's a very handsome man. So he's older than me. So he was apparently he was like because they're stunt guys, right? Isn't that the thing with him? Yeah, they're stunt guys. So they he made John Wick. They made John Wick, came out in 2014, starring Keanu Reeves and who else is in that movie? Keanu Reeves and Willem Dafoe, but only briefly. Willem Dafoe, Adrian Pilecki is in the movie. It's become like quite a thing. They're making the sequel out of it now. So you and I have never talked about it, so we should probably see it and talk about it. So best of you, if you've not seen John Wick, you should see it and talk about it with us next week. And we also have two movies to talk about. I'm very excited. One, we're going to talk about Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping, which I titled it. I just want to call so many different things, but I feel like the one that is actually kind of perfect. So Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping, which is from the Lonely Island guys. I'm a fan of those guys. You like those guys.
I like them quite a lot, yes.
Yeah, it's one of our most anticipated summer movies on our list. And we're also going to talk about OJ Made in America. Now, technically, I think there is this thought process. I'm curious, Christian, actually. Well, maybe we'll talk about this next week. Are film critics considering it a movie? Because it is, for the record, it is a movie. You know, it is a TV show. We'll be start launching on ABC and ESPN June 11th in five parts. But it is being released to theaters. It has already been released to theaters because they were trying to qualify for an Oscar. So technically speaking, though I'm seeing mostly TV critics reviewing it, it is in fact, by the context and the way we discuss these things, it is in fact a movie eligible for top 10 lists, eligible for everything along those lines. It's a movie.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had a Hall of Justice conversation with other film critics about it, but I feel like if that's how they want to look at it, that's what it is. I mean, the analogy I would say is Carlos, which was technically a miniseries, but was treated like a movie here in the U.S., so we thought of it as a movie. So yes, I think of this as a film.
I think I've been trying to convince people of it as a film because I wrote about it for New York Magazine. This is actually, I'm glad to finally have it be, when we talk about this next week, it will literally be the third podcast that I've talked about OJ in America on, though the first one that doesn't actually include the director. Ezra Edelman is the director of the movie. It's part of ESPN's 30 for 30 project, but it's actually a 7.5-hour movie. I did, unfortunately did not see it in theaters, but we did watch the screener of it, and we're going to talk about that next week because it is a movie. And even though we are previewing it, being on television on June 11th, it is a movie, so we're talking about it on the podcast. So next week, OJ Made in America, Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping, which is, let's not get our subtitles confused on that. Let's not make it Pop Star Made in America and OJ Never Stop, Never Stopping.
Well, we'll get into that next week,
We will get into that next week. But and of course, your reboot movie is John Wick. So of course, always make sure to give us a, of course, find our work at The New Republic. please tweet us or follow us at Grierson Leach, GRIERSONLEARTCH. Subscribe to us on iTunes, give us a nice review, SoundCloud, NewRepublic.com. Email us at GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com. Otherwise, we'll be back to talk about OJ Never Stop, Never Stopping, and pop star Maven America and John Wick next week. Grierson, I think we did a good job on this show.
I'm very proud of us.
See y'all.
Bye.